It's Tuesday, March 21st, 2006. You're moving at the speed of creativity with Wesley Fryer, narrowcasting from Orlando, Florida. Well, hello, and welcome to the third and final podcast from sessions that I attended today at the SITE 2006 conference. SITE is the Society for Information Technology and Teacher Education, which is one of the conferences that is sponsored by AACE, the Association for the Advancement of Computing and Education. This particular session was titled Lessons Learned from One-to-One Laptop Initiatives, Reflections on the Critical Components. And there was a very distinguished panel, which included Drs. Mike Muir from the University of Maine at Farmington, who's involved in the Maine Learning Technology Initiative Evaluation and Assessment. We had Gerald Knezik, and Rhonda Christensen from the University of North Texas that are involved in the Irving ISD Laptop Initiative. We had Kathy Norris from North Texas and Elliot Soloway from the University of Michigan who were talking about handheld initiatives as well as laptop initiatives. We had Ian Gibson from Macquarie University in Australia, who is actually talking about a one-to-one setting in Sydney, Australia, as well as one in Sedgwick County, or I guess Sedgwick High School, which is near Wichita, Kansas. And then we also had Peter Albion from the University of Southern Queensland in Australia. So a very distinguished panel talking about the lessons that are coming out of one-to-one learning initiatives, and I really found this to be a superb session, and if you've been listening to my podcast for any length of time, you know that it's my contention that one-to-one learning is definitely the future of education. It may not be the future of education in the school district where you happen to teach right now or where your students happen to attend, but the potential to access digital curriculum and have a device that allows for not only the flexible access of content, but the dynamic creation and communication of content, it's phenomenal. And the price of these tools is just continuing to come down. So whereas just a few short years ago, we had folks saying one-to-one learning was not feasible, it was not practical, we could maybe do things with handhelds, but not with laptops, we're certainly seeing the proliferation of one-to-one initiatives across the country, and the types of research that is being done by professors like those in this panel is very important for us to follow, not only as we seek to learn the lessons of how these things are being done well or being done poorly, but also as we seek to talk to other community stakeholders, wherever we might happen to be, about the reasonable expectations we can have for a one-to-one learning initiative if it is implemented properly. And that was certainly a message that we heard echoed by several of the presenters. And anyway, I won't drone on more, but just want to thank the presenters for sharing their perspectives and also for the work that they're doing and their permission to share this as a podcast with you.
Our goal.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Yep.
Right. My name is Mike Muir. I'm at the University of Maine at Farmington, and I have the distinct pleasure of convening this panel today. We've got a collection of folks that have been involved in, at one level or another, one-to-one initiatives or ubiquitous computing initiatives, both laptop and handhelds and other technologies. And going back to our keynote this morning, this is going to be very exciting because it is a bunch of diverse perspectives and different points of view. The format for today's panel, after we do a brief introduction of each of our speakers, is each speaker will have a few minutes to share about their initiative or their perspective. And the goal is to save the last half hour for questions and answers from the audience. Okay? So I'm Mike Muir, and I'm representing two initiatives, the Maine Learning Technology Initiative. Every 7th and 8th grade middle school student in the state has a laptop, and one of the pilot programs in Massachusetts.
I'm Gerald Knezik, University of North Texas. Rhonda and I are reporting on the Irving initiatives.
Hello.
He's the president of SITE.
All right, let's move on from that. I have two projects to talk about. One is a very elite private school in Sydney, and the other is a high school in a small rural, close to Wichita district in Kansas, both of which have got the one-to-one initiative going, got different perspectives totally about the way they go about it.
I'm Peter Albion from the University of Southern Queensland, Australia. I'm not quite sure why I'm here. I think I'm the resident skeptic.
Right.
Converted skeptic.
I'm Kathy
Norris,
and I have candy in my mouth. I didn't realize we were going to do this first. from the University of North Texas. And I'm here to talk about, it doesn't make any difference which device. The emphasis should not be on the technology. The emphasis should be on the learning.
Yeah, there you go. And I'm going to follow up talking about learning environments as opposed to applications.
All right, thank you. The our machine's a little slow. I've gone over the format. The Maine Learning Technology Initiative, we've just completed our fourth year, fifth if you count the pilot sites and the planning year. We have over 39,000 laptops deployed to 7th and 8th grade students and teachers. And we got started the spring of 2002 where our exploration sites rolling out to the rest of the 7th graders in the fall of 2002. And we say we added it for the 8th grade in the fall of 2003, but as you can imagine, what really happened is the 7th graders took their laptops to 8th grade, and we got a new collection of laptops for the new 7th graders. Fall of 2004, the original goal was to move this into high schools as well. Funding did not hold up for that. And so we've got about 40 high schools that are working at their own level, a lot more that are looking at CARTs as a possibility. The good news about funding is even though we're not going ahead with the high schools, the middle grades program has been fully integrated into the education budget next year. So it's not a separate budget, it's fully part of the education budget. And we've got a article that Gerald and Rhonda and I collaborated on about the power to one-to-one in what was it, November 04? Issue of Learning and Leading with Technology. One of the things that we've done is we've tried to really stay focused on teaching and learning and not hardware deployment, and backing that up, of course, with good tech support, backing it up with lots of professional development. We're especially interested in looking at some of our students who had laptops, who had computers at school or could bring the computer home from school, versus the kids who did not have a computer at home or were not allowed to bring one home. Maine is a local control state. The state could not tell districts to let kids take them home. Districts decided this on their own. And using some of the measures from the University of North Texas, we found that the students at home, with access at home, had higher attitude towards school, self-concept, email skill, and total computer skill than the kids who could not. We also ran some preliminary data on MEA scores, our state testing, which happens at the 8th grade. And although we were using school average data instead of individual student data, it hinted at a moderate effect size of 0.2 that in math and science and visual and performing arts, there was significant improvement with the laptops. We were actually running this data to show need for math and science, and the data from the state is broken into two files, and so that's why we don't have any of the data on the reading or the writing. The file that we had included the science, the math, social studies, and visual and performing arts. And what has grown out of this is, and working with the state, is a model for success. We believe there are two critical components, teacher practice and leadership. They make or break what happens with a laptop initiative. And then four, supporting but necessary. They're not the most important, but boy, you're in trouble if you don't have them. They include tech support and access, professional development, funding, and partnerships. The yellow handout that's coming around has this model on there. It also has a link if you want the color PDF instead of the black and white printout. I'm also involved in the evaluation of the New Bedford Global Learning Charter School. New Bedford is a right at the southeastern corner of Massachusetts that has right near Cape Cod, right near Rhode Island. They're a whaling. They have the National Whaling Museum, and this is a charter school, Horace Mann School, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. They've added 9th and 10th grade, and they've got a grant to be one of the state pilot sites, and they're also doing some really fabulous stuff. One of their strengths is they have these wonderful partnerships with organizations that can help their teachers with content and to make real-world connections. Not only is using technology in their charter, so is global connections. And so that's a real strength. And I think we're on to Texas.
Yes. Irving, Texas is a suburban metropolitan school district of about 39 schools. If you know of it at all, the Dallas Cowboys football stadium is in the middle of Irving. And roughly one-third of the size of Maine was the original implementation of laptops in Irving. So even though it's one district, it's quite large. The implementation was at the secondary school level. Actually, they didn't start with all of those. They phased it in over 3 years, with one of four major high schools getting them the first year. We've been conducting program evaluation now for 3 years at Irving on that overall initiative. The research design involved a number of different ways of assessing what was going on. 40 classrooms were randomly picked and observed by other people besides ourselves. There were focus group interviews at all the schools. We had online teacher and student surveys that have been reported in a number of places, including the December-January edition of Leading and Learning with Technology. I have reprints about 20 of those, and Ian, if you don't mind doing the honors, you can read about that and also probably find that online. Next slide, if we could.
This works too.
So what have we found so far? Well, a number of things, but four that are most interesting. The laptop program is now the strongest single factor that new teachers say they use to select coming to the Irving Independent School District. Other findings, is Neil Topp in the room? Neil? Yes, we know that students are very attracted as well, and parents move in. That's similar to Maine findings and similar to what I think Neil is finding in Nebraska. The guided facilitated instruction has replaced direct instruction as the most common mode. That is, the guide on the side is real. To survive in Irving, you have to operate that way now. There are many students, this was a corollary finding they didn't really expect. More than the instructional staff of Irving is the students who say they take their computers home and teach their parents or their younger brothers or sisters how to use them. And in a place that's 40% Hispanic, first language Spanish, well, we believe that will change the community a lot in the long run. The biggest problem is classroom management. In fact, the single largest problem is that. You can read for details in there. I think it's enough, a brief introduction. Rhonda?
Oh, sorry, I went too far.
Yep.
Back one?
Maybe not. No, one more. Sorry.
I'm not a remote control person. I'm like, boys do remote control. What's kind of neat about Irving is they've had the laptop in their high schools for several years, but then they were awarded a state-funded technology immersion pilot project, which allowed it to be a vertical. So they have it one elementary school, one middle school, and it's back one. And one, and then their high schools, of course. And I think, Wesley, aren't you collaborating with one employee data or something in West Texas? So he's one of the middle school ones. There were several, 22 middle schools, but only one vertical integration one. So we get to work with Irving. And as an aside, we did a lot of focus group interviews with the teachers at all levels, and it seems like elementary teachers are a lot more embracing of having that in their classroom is what we kind of surmised from that, from just talking with all the teachers. And we're not sure exactly why, unless it's because they have a self-contained classroom. But anyway, we can discuss that later. They have a comparison group as well as the schools that receive laptops in Texas. So they're looking at the kids who get the laptops in these 22 middle schools as well as that. And then in Irving, we also have a comparison classroom for the lower school, the elementary and middle school. What we have found so far is that the treatment teachers are higher on most of their technology skills, which you might expect because they have technology available all the time. Although in Irving, the teachers have all had laptops for several years. So that's an important thing, I think, to know also. And then, as I think you've seen in Maine, discipline referrals have gone down in both the middle school and the elementary school. So that's kind of a neat thing that's across projects we've worked with.
The Australian context is a little different than what we've heard so far, and I've selected one school that's representative of one level of schooling, I suppose, that provides an interesting example of the variety of school types that we deal with in Australia. The first one here is the Methodist Ladies College in Sydney. This is a very elite, select school. Clearly kids in Australia go to school in school uniforms, and there's a very strong ethos around that and what it might mean in terms of correct behaviour and so on. But we can move past that quite quickly, I think, to the idea of having just a visual image, basically, of the sort of situations we find there. And I want you to focus on the visual imagery here because it's very ordered and very correct in some ways. And again, I want to make that point too, because what is happening in this particular school is that there is an attempt to create a school for the future, and that's part of what their rhetoric is. So if you have a scan through those five bullet points, you'll see that there's a very strong high-end technology focus on providing a school that is designed to cater to the upper echelon in some ways of the educational elite. The point is that there's a really nice hardware establishment here that allows the use of the technology to go through flawlessly without too much of an issue about technology maintenance, whether the stuff works or not, when teachers and kids want to use it. You can see there that it would be nice if all of us had the opportunity to have that level of support in school. Now, going on to having a look at the sort of things that actually occur there, the people at this school have actually worked it to use the technology to integrate the school's activities with the community's activities. So there's a real attempt to break down the barriers in terms of distance and in terms of interacting with different groups and so on outside of the school's community. If you can have a look at some of those points, you can see that there is also an impact on the way that teaching occurs and the sorts of activity that they involve their kids in. The whole idea of developing and enhancing evidence-based practice is not just something that's being applied to the school teachers in the school, but also being applied to the students who are learning in a variety of different subject areas. It's a very traditional school still, regardless of the level of interactivity and communication that occurs. There's been very little impact upon the pedagogy, the predominant way of learning, and the view of the definition of what learning is and how it should occur. In fact, the traditional perspective of MLC has been maintained fairly strongly, despite the large intrusion of education, of technology into the predominant paradigm of schooling and teaching. So it's a very unique situation. What I find, though, in this school is that there's a very positive and accepting way of the role that teachers still play in guiding and controlling and leading the learning environment, and kids are still responding, but they are introducing a few ideas. It's not like you would expect the kids owning and engaging fully in owning the learning experience. Moving to the cross-cultural comparison side of things now, is taking a look at Sedgwick High School in Sedgwick County, Kansas. There's a very strong emphasis here in having the impact of technology on a one-to-one basis affect the pedagogical style, pedagogical model that they use there. And so there's a very strong emphasis on giving the kids control. And it's unusual in this sense when you compare the two, because in the images that you see here, there's a nice spot on the website that you might want to have a look at. If you give a kid an iBook, is the introduction to the whole thing. If you give a kid an iBook, what sort of thing happens? And as you can see in the pictures, it's a less ordered environment, a lot messier, in a productive learning sense. And there's definitely an ownership question that kids are representing. And these sorts of questions are the ones that are being asked in this particular school system. When you have a read of those, you can see that these people would say that the answer to all of these questions is yes. And so it has had a large impact on the major issues that people in the Midwest have been struggling with in terms of motivation, discipline, ownership, kid control. And the issue, here's one of the interesting issues, and I'll let go on beyond it. There's always that issue of whether if you give kids unrestrained access to the internet, they might go and have a look at nasty little sites that might do them damage. Yeah, sure. You can do it without technology as well. The issue is that you train the kids to have the responsibility and ownership.
Yeah.
They've got the benefit of having this technology, and if they have the responsibility of maintaining that benefit, they're not going to stuff it, to use the phrase that they use.
Amen. Amen. Absolutely.
It takes a while to respond. Just to push it back.
Now, I've been billed as doing the long-term view, and really I suppose my interest in this goes back 10 years or thereabouts, when one of the private schools in the local area where I am in Queensland went with a laptop program, which at that stage was very popular around the countryside in Australia. Lots of schools, lots of private schools were going with laptop programs. This particular school introduced a laptop program and then proceeded to say, we're going to make this optional. And then proceeded to go further and to say, not only will it be optional, but the children whose parents choose not to participate will find that their children are not disadvantaged. You stop for a moment, you think about that. We're going to do something which we think is actually educationally valuable. We're going to do it with some of the students, and the other students are not going to be disadvantaged. There seems to be a logical gap in there somewhere. And you start to wonder then how much of this is really about education and how much was about marketing. At that time, I suspect, in that case in particular, a lot of it was really about marketing. So we had a dual marketing push from schools for trying to edge for a marketing position. With others, in this case, it was in a community where there were a number of schools that might have been direct competitors, none of which had a laptop program, and so you put yourself in a market-leading position. Of course, we had companies at the same time marketing equipment, so that was all part of it. When you started to look more closely at what were the advantages of laptop programs, at that stage certainly the research seemed to suggest that there were advantages, but the advantages that were there seemed to be the same advantages that had come out of things like the ACOT program, that the advantages were of having the technology. Nobody had really looked closely to see whether there was a particular advantage to having the laptop. And when you start to think further through that, really what's important is that kids and teachers have got access to the data, access to the processing power they need to get the job done. And whether that means having desktops at school, laptops on carts, computers at home, laptops you carry with you, PDAs, or whatever, or increasingly in this day and age, Web 2 and ubiquitous computing, really is a moot point, I suspect. As long as you've got the access and it's pedagogically driven, then you're going to get the effect. It's not really so much a question of owning the computer. There may be some advantages in that, but it's not clear how much is there. And that's really, I guess, what I'm trying to say where is the focus? Is it on marketing, or has it been sometimes on marketing? What should it be on? I would think the learning and the teaching that goes on. And the other question that's in my mind now is, will ubiquitous access, the capacity to reach in as we're doing today into blogs and from wherever we are, whatever computer we can pick up, access our data and do our stuff with it, does that make a difference?
Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you. And I agree completely with what people have been saying. What we're talking about is the learning. And what we've been seeing in the last 6 months is that the learning, the access, is moving from the early adopters. And you know, the early adopters can do anything with technology. You don't have to hold their hand. But all of a sudden, in the last 6 months, with access being more and more to the early majority, that's a completely different type of animal. How do you care and feed the early majority as opposed to the early adopters? And we know forever that schools don't really want technology. Schools want learning. That's the point. Technology happens to be the means to that learning. But the technology itself is not and should not be the focus. So how do we use whatever technology it is to improve the learning for children? We came across the term convergent learning. We actually were thinking of it, and when we started looking it up, we found that someone by the name of Susan McLester wrote about the idea of convergent learning in an article in Technology and Learning in 2001. And she cited scenarios where learning was, the different scenarios were converging. And that it's happening in many, many places without technology, using things like team teaching, project-based learning, and so on. And what convergent learning really is opportunities. It is new opportunities that are multi-source, they're multi-person, they're multimodal, they're multi-day. Things that you know, that where all of the different learning opportunities converge. And it just so happens that the outcome of this convergence, of being able to bring all of this together, is not only simple learning of essential elements, but it results in a much deeper understanding on the part of children. They're understanding things better. The problem is that to really get this type of understanding, we do in fact need some type of technology. Example, I'm just going to give you an example of convergent learning. And this happens to be on a smaller screen. We focused on smaller screens initially because we saw that the laptop model was not going to be able to scale across the country. That schools in general across the country simply did not have the money to provide laptops for everyone. It wasn't initial purchase price. It was total cost of ownership over multiple years. So we started looking at other devices, anything sub-XP, and there's a range of devices in that area, screen sizes, of capabilities, just depends on what you want. But the idea of convergent learning, here you see many, many different types of documents on one screen. This is a project page, and the idea is that children can go back and forth, they can do concept mapping from their project page with a single click. They can open and create a concept map. They can open and create Word documents. Single click going back and forth so that they're focused on a main project. They can open and create animations, drawing and animations. Multiple linked representations with a single click. Always focused on their main project page and going back and forth. Now, we know that some students will excel at writing, where others will excel in drawing, where others, like Elias perhaps, have to have it all mapped out. However they excel, they do them all. They have the opportunity to do all of these things, and they can do it on one device. And the good news is that the technology that we need to do this is readily available now. When Susan McLester wrote about this converged learning in 2001, we didn't have the capability to bring it all together easily and inexpensively, and now we do.
And coming back to this idea of the mainstream, this is a chart from Crossing the Chasm, a book about how technology spreads. And you can see at the leftmost margin, the early adopters, that's where technology over the last 30 years has remained. It has not hit the mainstream. However, what we're starting to see are these little fires in the mainstream, and there are different kind of demands that teachers in the mainstream require in terms of support, in terms of curriculum, in terms of professional development. And so it's a different kind of model that we have to do to get there. Now, the genie, in fact, the one-to-one genie is out of the bottle. It doesn't matter about SBIR, small business. scientific-based research, whether you can have it or not, it doesn't matter. There are opportunities, and the technology is there. Okay, so Let's talk about the learning, sort of the first go at this when we dealt with the early adopters. We did have the one-to-ones, and they were the laptops. And if you look at it, you look at the audience, and you look at the access, what the one-to-one was trying to do was deal with the access problem. That's what we were trying to deal with. And what we had were, we called them, the big word is productivity apps. But if you think about it, it's really clerical apps. It's get the kids to read, write, basic stuff, which is not bad, but it's clerical apps. Now, a gentleman by the name of William Fanuel wrote a report by looking at all the one-to-one laptop stuff, and this is what he thought he saw with one-to-one. Across a wide range of studies, students use laptops primarily for writing, taking notes, completing homework assignments, keeping organized, communicating with peers and teachers, and researching topics. For these tasks, they are using word processing software, web processors, web browsers, email, and chat. Use of software programs designed to teach basic skills appears to be less common. The kids were using the basic stuff. And what we need to do now to get to the convergent learning, to get to the next level, is we have to think about learning environments where things are integrated, where we're not overwhelmed with 16,000 menus, we're not overwhelmed with the file systems and all the other technological gobbledygook. And what you saw, what Kathy showed you, was a very simplistic, simple system. It can run on laptops, it can run on handhelds. Handhelds, in fact, are very powerful little devices. You might not like the screen size, but they're Pentium 3-level machines. They're very, very, very powerful. And if you think about it, you have this notion of task-appropriate, low-cost. You have learner-centered, low-cost, and et cetera, et cetera. And what the technology is giving us now is this unprecedented opportunity to create a learning environment. Now, I want to go one more step and deal with something Peter said. This issue of having the technology available, if you really deal with the kids, right, if you really deal with the kids, it is totally about ownership. When they have their device in their hand, their lives are different. It's not about using somebody else's computer. I take tremendous disagree with Peter tremendously on this one. The kid, I don't want to say the word, I'm so angry. Well, I'm not angry, but upset. Just because you see what happens when the kids have it in their hands, it is completely different. And that's why the one-to-one is absolutely critically important. We cannot go back to the carts. The carts are an absolute misguided idea. If we can't do one-to-one, then we've got to figure out how to do one-to-one. If it's not going to be laptops, then we can do something else. It's got to be one-to-one.
Slate.
One
slate. Right. The last thing that I'm going to share before we open it up for questions,
sure.
I have to thank my colleagues because I don't know if you know any of these people, but we all are talkers and have lots of stories to share. And the fact that we got them all to stay within a 5-minute level is no small deal. And I don't think it's because of my threatening emails prior to the presentation. But the last thing I wanted to share with you is I've just started a project. It's still in beta. The shape of the website is changing. But the one-to-one stories project, a lot of people, how many of you are considering a one-to-one initiative? How many of you that are considering have actually lived in one before? See, that's the issue, is that a lot of people haven't experienced it. So stories are an important way to convey information. And for the most part, people don't need information, they need experiences. And if you haven't experienced it, stories are other people's experiences. If you're in a one-to-one initiative, we'd love you to join and share your stories. There's about 30 or 40 stories on there right now from teachers, from some of these folks. And it's not just about laptops. It can be about ubiquitous computing. It can be about handhelds. We really believe strongly that this is a way so that we can learn from each other, and people who are new to this can learn from the people who've gone before them. So we've got about a half hour for questions. You can direct them to the panel or to individuals.
Jim Greenlaw from Tampa. I'm researching 250 kids in three schools in Brunswick, which is across the border from Maine. We have been doing one-on-one laptop project for about a year and a half, and we'll be able to write it up this summer. We're really interested. I'm really interested in one-on-one story.org thing, so you'll hear from me by the end of the summer.
Great.
I have to agree with Elliot, but not as a tell, I'm not going to take anymore, but I wander around with your laptop, and it's really cute sometimes how they're hardly aware that this thing is not part of their physical self. It's all that it goes everywhere. I think it's a much more natural environment than having to go to the corner of the room where your computer is bolted down. So I agree completely with Elliot on that. I'm wondering about the handhelds, whether or not that is, I think handhelds sound like a great idea, and I haven't really tried them, but it gets to need, you know, be able to type on a big keyboard and see something. That might be a problem.
We advocate that you got to have the keyboards for the kids. You absolutely have to have the keyboards. And they got it. You know, they have a keyboard and a handheld. They throw them in their backpacks. And it's still a blended solution. They still got the machines. But yes, $60, $70, you got to buy keyboards.
Okay, the price of decreasing price of laptop computers eventually going to make handheld options?
No, you're always going to have moving parts. The moment you have moving parts. And the moment you have XP or Mac OS devices, you have tremendous drain on batteries. You're not going to get an 8-hour battery to run. It ain't going to be. There are not more laws things in the technology. The moment you go to a less demanding device, you get longer battery life, no moving parts, lower TC, total cost of ownership. That's what it is. It's what's interesting. There's a new device coming out that's going to be able, if you boot it up in XP, it's a laptop. You boot it up in XP, you got 2 hours on the battery. You boot it up in Windows CE, you got 8 hours. It's that simple. And it's demands all the other characteristics of the computational environment that make demands on the hardware. You just can't do it. That's why the handhelds, in some sense, are lower total cost of ownership. You get more out of them. There's a downside. You don't have the big screen.
I think what's much more likely is to see a convergence of technologies into something new that's somewhere in between a handheld and a laptop.
And
the $100 laptop project, I think, is a classic example of that. It's kind of interesting how every other major laptop producer, almost every other major laptop producer, is claiming that nobody wants a scaled down laptop. And they're complaining about it immensely.
But again,
but they do. Right.
Right. Right.
But again, it's not an either or situation. It's
right.
Not you can either have this or you can have this. The idea is that schools have already invested a great deal of money in infrastructure. They already have labs. They already have one or two computers in the back of the classrooms. Many of them already have computers on carts. The idea is simply to fill out the infrastructure, to leverage what you've already got by spending a smaller amount to give the children their own personal device. And they can go back and forth between a big screen and their handheld when they need it. When they don't have to. And there are properties of the small screens that make them uniquely appropriate. One of Gerald's graduate students was working with a group of Girls Inc. students. Now these are at-risk girls, and they were eighth graders. And there were 70 girls, so there were like seven groups of 10. And she was asking them, what content would you like to see on a small device? And about the third or fourth time someone said multiplication, she said, wait, tell me more. Tell me more about multiplication. And the girl said, my times tables. She said, I don't know my times tables and I want to learn them. And Teresa said, well, don't you have lots of software at the school that you could use in the media center to learn it? And she said, yes, but then everyone could see what I'm doing. This is private. And the privacy issue we've also seen in Detroit, that students say, I can read on this, and because of the instant on, instant off, if my friends come up, I can turn it off, so they don't know that I'm reading my lessons.
This issue of what we call the Avion versus the water fountain solution to ubiquitous access is something we're very interested in. I think there needs to be dissertations done on this topic. In fact, one of our doctoral students is interested in trying to build a scale that would, in fact, let a person self-assess the value they place on personal ownership. The neighboring school district to Irving, Carrollton Farmers Branch, has 37 schools, and they've taken the everywhere access anytime approach, just the opposite of the one-to-one initiative. And we're anxious to see what happens in that case. I think there still needs to be more study on this issue.
Jester?
Exactly, because I think there are more and more web-based services. Mm-hmm. You need updated data. I mean, in a business environment, yeah, you don't have data stored on individual computers. You have a web-based solution.
Exactly.
I mean, counterproductive to what you say, and more towards that we just log in, we just use any kind of device wherever we find it. There's a growth. You used to have a mainframe for maybe 100 persons. Now you have a PC one-to-one. In the future, you will have maybe, I mean, it depends how you define a computer, in fact. Mm-hmm. You have computing power, processing power, anywhere, mm-hmm, right? And you have maybe 10 computers per player.
But then the cell phone is exactly the access with that kind of movable data. It's exactly what the kids are doing.
Margaret Moran from Michigan State University, and we were involved in the evaluation of Michigan's Freedom to Learn program in the first year that it rolled out. And then in that particular pilot year of the program, they allowed schools to choose whatever platforms they wanted. About a third of them chose handheld devices, and the other two-thirds chose laptops. And interestingly, what we found is that was the one most distinguishing characteristic in attitudes among teachers and students, was the sites where they were using the handhelds, they actually had less positive responses to the computing. And as best we could tell, most of these teachers were very experienced, had about eight years average experience using technology. So a laptop's not a new piece of technology for them. They didn't have difficulty figuring out what to do. And the same way with the students, many of whom had seen computers before. They're confronted with a handheld, they didn't know what to do. Many of the students thought they were going to be Game Boys when they weren't allowed to play games. They first got them when they went home and do all these kinds of things. So, you know, issues with the keyboards, which while they're flaky and they fail a lot. So, you know, that was one of the interesting outcomes that we saw.
I think every person up here would say that probably next to what the teachers do with it and what the principal is saying to encourage them to do that is professional development,
Exactly.
And it needs to be in the context of teaching with technology,
right,
not computer skills. And skills need to be taught,
right,
but within the context of how do you use this device for teaching.
Right, and the teachers, I mean, the small screens were an issue because, you know, it's hard to cooperatively work with your peers on a tiny little screen.
Right.
And, you know, those were all issues that they were struggling with.
Wing and then...
Well, there's a question I actually wanted to ask. We are all interested in learning, right? Smart technology. But I've been dealing technology all the time, comparing laptop and handheld devices. For example, handheld devices are great, right? They're interesting, they're powering. But what sort of learning can they afford? Can you give some examples of what the learning?
You can do everything on a little guy that you can do on a laptop. And in fact, the argument that Kathy was making is that you do more because the applications that are running on the handheld are learning environments, not clerical applications. Now, one can move the learning environments to laptops. There's no reason why not. In fact, that's a good idea. But the point is that you have a learning environment, and that facilitates the convergent learning.
There are some things that are a little different, unless my understanding is off. And but it's not definitely not the case of you should need to choose one over the other. It's about choosing the right tool at the right time. For instance, Chris Deedy has developed some simulation software that works in conjunction with GPS that works much better on a handheld, some simulation work. Whereas if you're going to do multimedia production with students, which a lot of Maine teachers do, iMovie ended up being one of the most widely used programs, that's very hard. I don't even know if there is anything like that on handhelds. So there is some difference, but you're absolutely right. We need to be talking about, you know, if we get into the debate about laptops and handhelds, it's not too far off from the PC versus Mac debate,
right,
and it's largely a religious war based on what you're enthusiastic about, you know. And but the one thing I know all these people well enough to know, regardless of whether it's ubiquitous computing or handhelds or laptops, we're all talking about creating learning environments. And you make a good point. We need to talk more about the learning. Teresa?
Well, yes. be on the learning side. I've been following a laptop school, which is a school program, for 9 years. Okay, so the parents bought the laptop starting in 97, and there was a need assessment before, and it was a school that wanted to compete with private schools. Okay, that's the setting. Near Laval University, about 4 miles. And I've had student teachers there over the years, so that always gave me an inside look within classrooms, and I've been there a lot. And every year I get less and less to say about the program. And I'm going to tell you, the first effects we saw, we did not see them afterwards. And but there are things that remain constant. For instance, the professional learning community got stronger, maybe 3 years after it started. And now it's starting to fade down because there are about 20 teachers working the program now. And then you have the specialists. And the thing is getting more and more complex. So it's like you start to see the problems that are on the regular, in the regular classroom and the other committee of practice within the school. So that's there. One constant effect that we have found is that the kids, they lose their motivation with their laptop, but they lose it significantly less than the kids in regular classrooms. We have a very strong result on that. Another strong result is that there is less dropout, definitely, very, very little dropout. And those classrooms are mainly boards, maybe 85%. So that's a pretty good result in and of itself. And we have been following them in college, in Quebec, we have college and then university. They went through college pretty well. They had much more fun in high school. And they are performing well, you know. And this is what we can see. This is probably in a nutshell what we can see after 9 years. Of course, there is a lot, you know, that we have written about. But never to get to reach of having a very strong article on that. Because we felt we had a bias because the parents bought the computers. So we know they were already in a home where parents care about education. So we always found some biases that made us not really trust the results we have.
I think one of the things that's really important to look at from a point of view of learning is if you go to what Johnson and Maddox call type 1 and type 2 uses of technology, type 1 is automating conventional practice. And there's an incremental gain in benefit. But not a big benefit, and in business has found that type 1 practices it does not provide a bang for the buck. And I think we see a lot, and really type 1 uses is not a bad place to start with adaptation, with moving, if you look at it as a process of moving teachers along. But a lot of schools don't then look at type 2 uses, which are what could you do with the technology that you could not do easily or effectively or at all without the technology. And I think that the next phase is to really look at schools in terms of what they're doing in terms of phase 1 and phase 2.
Let me see what project-based learning. It's over 80% project-based learning and inquiry-based learning.
Yeah, project-based learning, inquiry-based learning, technology tools, digital storytelling. There's several models that are all about.
I've been hearing a lot about matching the technology to the environment as well as to the content. Have we done additional research to look at the individual learner and their preference for content type based on the different learning modalities and how students learn, particularly given differences among our learners?
Wants to address that?
Well, I teach my pre-service students all the time that it's just another tool in your repertoire that allows you to meet different learners' needs, whether or not you know exactly what type of learner every kid is in your classroom or not. If you do different types of strategies and modalities and different types of include technology, you're going to hit those kids more of the time. So I don't know if that's part of.
Well, David,
I have three quick ones. I got
problems. He's not limited.
Yeah, yeah. On this issue of why the appropriateness, and also to your question about, well, you know, in what ways can it be used to adapt your content? There's three quick stories. One is that the GPS model, there were kids from, or master's degree level students, I should say. Now I'm just getting older, so who were designing place-based games at MIT where the GPS, you walk around the city of Arlington trying to figure out who shot the first shot of the American Revolution. So the whole experience involves several people using the physical space of the town, and as you go to a different place in the town, you get different information about where you're at because the GPS is causing the content of that location to come up in a different way. a group of people in the Swiss Technical Institute in the architecture department as an experiment, were given a year's worth of time with their professors to build what really amounted to an orientation game for new students, where it was the wireless LAN of buildings shooting out information of where you are, and they built a game in which several players used their handheld, and you get to a location, and what was on the handheld at the location was not only what the building was giving you, but who else was near and what did they know. And you were trying to put together knowledge from that. Same with that American Revolution, you had multiple perspectives. You go through the whole game playing a role, and at the end you'd have to try to compare what you learned with what five other people learned in the same physical space but given different data sets. So it was really moving the uses of the technology along. On the learning styles issue, a guy in Korea right now has a proposal out. It hasn't been translated effectively yet into English, but the idea of it is on the handheld, you're the learner, and you come up to a decision point on the content that you're looking at, and you're deciding, would I rather have it this way or that way? So you hit a button, and you get a slightly different download at that point. And you come to another location, hit another one, and in each of those locations, it's matching what are you preferring to see and do with content that's been prepared for that. So there's just three quick examples that use handhelds in that vein of which we're talking about. Now,
all right. I think we're all saying the same thing. I think that we're saying that there's good that comes out of it. But what I think the conversation should be is about what's the evidence of effect on learning achievement. Okay. Ownership. Okay. Well, how do you document, you know, what that look like in terms of achievement and learning?
God help you. That's the honest answer. God help him. And he ain't helping.
Well, I'll feel that one.
Yeah, but you're
so, go ahead. Well, I'll feel that one a little bit. There are two projects going on. One is a paper we'll present at AERA about one of the water fountain districts that I mentioned, where it seems that there is credible evidence that even that ubiquitous approach does result in higher standardized achievement scores among the students who had that access. And so I think the issue is not access, but what you do with it. And again, this district does a good job of professional development and content-oriented instruction with that mode. Would it be higher or lower in a laptop environment? We don't know, but that's one study. The second is that we have a doctoral student that Kathy mentioned who is working on Mike's data in Maine focusing on the issue of gender differences in math achievement. But a byproduct of that, or a first question is there any credible evidence of higher achievement at all? And you can get at that question by the extent of reported use of the laptops in the learning environment among their 228 middle schools. That to me is quite convincing for a dissertation, even if it doesn't comply with SCI or randomly assigned guidelines.
Right.
So I think some of that's coming.
Let me add one. People forget the achievement can be measured with formative assessment measures.
Sure.
And that's what you don't see, you know, in the literature. I mean, I knew that we were going to go test for a route, and I'm like, no, that's not what I'm talking about. It's too often we're forgetting about all the measures out there on the formative assessment level where you can, you know, measure at the beginning and measure at the end and talk about that, what happens in between.
But the really important thing to remember that really mucks this up in terms of some sort of clean data collection is that it is not a technology initiative, it's a learning initiative.
Right.
And if you're not also measuring the professional development, the leadership, the
right.
tech support and access, how teachers are using it, and it gets so messy to collect information on that scale. You can't really answer that. We got the question all the time, do laptops improve learning? And we just got to the point where we say the answer is no, teachers improve learning. But you know what? Teachers with laptops and training do a heck of a lot better job than the ones without. And we can back that up anecdotally. But when we start, it depends on your standard of what counts as evidence.
Right.
But
I found Ian's comment very intriguing that in that Sydney school, teachers' perceptions of what school should look like, if I heard you right, hadn't changed a whole lot. And in Texas, my perception of some of the schools we've worked with is that we're not doing a learning initiative in terms of a reform initiative, but really a technology and efficiency project. We're going to use technology to make traditional teaching and learning and the transmission of content more efficient. So would you all respond to that and talk about how we address that? Mike talked about the leadership component being so essential, but is there a way that people are trying to get a handle on what extent are teachers in the school embracing a project-based approach or convergence learning, to use your language? Because that seems to be the key. Are we just trying to do traditional school more efficient, or are we trying to really do school differently?
Well, I think that, as Mike said at the beginning, you start with the old. And we talk about evolution, not revolution. I mean, many of you remember the old days. We used to roll in the technology and we said, you're going to have to learn, you're going to throw everything out, start all over, and learn basic, right? Write curriculum, right? And that was just like a stupid thing to say to teachers. Because that's not, you know, they're not going to do it. And so we learned that you got to start where they are. And what we're seeing in the at least in our schools, that you know, Apple Classroom and Tomorrow said, ACOP said, takes 3 to 5 years for teachers to really adopt and embrace the technology and change their practices to do Type 2. What we're seeing is, in fact, is half the time in the handheld schools. That adopting and adapting the technology takes a year, year and a half, and they're got it. And you can see differences in their instructional strategies, instructional practices in that year and a half. And so they're doing more Type 2 than Type 1.
Yeah. So what Elliot's saying is, you know, shift happened.
That's right.
I had a comment. Wes, I think you're absolutely right. What we're really doing is playing by the current administration or guidelines or thinking rules of sort of competency-based education to demonstrate that technology in the hands of good teachers and learners is 10% to 50% more effective per year, so that we can get them all there, because we believe it's going to be 10 times better in the learning that we're not measuring. That's really important.
And that's the strategic marketing that gets it in the door so that you can take it farther.
Right.
Neil? I'm sorry.
Some of my questions have been answered. You know, I'm curious about the professional development, and you know, how they started to talk about it. But, you know, and over time, you know, initially it's, you know, a motivator and engaged in school, but where and how are you getting the critical thinking kind of professional development going? What sort of collaborative environment are you creating to make this kind of thing happen when you're saying
if no one else is going to talk, I
didn't hear the question.
The question was about professional development and how are we focusing on higher order thinking, collaborative environments. Does that capture the essence? In Maine, we decided that the initial training was not going to be nuts and bolts. We have about 2 hours of the 2-day training, about 2 hours, and how do you turn it on? And because we had staff that hadn't done it before, but then everything else was not how do you use spreadsheets. It was, how do you teach data collection and analysis with spreadsheets? And so we modeled all along the teaching and the learning. We have regional content meetings so people can get together with other people who teach the same subject. We always start with an agenda, but the first thing we do in the day is get people to share what's going well and what are their challenges they're facing. Then we find out what else do they want to know about, and we pull the expertise right in the classroom. And so it's not just the facilitators that are presenting by the end of the day, but the people that are there from different schools. And rarely do I see someone say, we're having a huge problem with this, that someone else doesn't say, here's how we solve that problem. And that we're also working with the principals to make sure there's more and more embedded in-school staff development within the regular contract day, whether that's sharing at staff meetings or quick skill shops or something like that. Who else wants to add to the professional development?
Are there online communities for these teachers? Are they volunteering?
Well, we have every teacher was assigned a MLTI email address so that we could share information, and then they can build their own communities from that. And I think the face-to-face meetings have also helped foster independent communication. You know, you meet someone who's got similar interests at another school, and you start on your own conversing with them. And I think we have time for one last.
I was going to ask the same question on professional development. I just wanted to add that we, in
our project, we've got one mentor teacher for each of the three schools, and that person helps to orchestrate the balance between pull-out sessions where you get a bunch of teachers together, and the mentor, him or herself, going into the teacher's classroom to work with the teacher on site. And, you know, at first we were giving them too much of the pull-out stuff. Usually, now I want to be with my kids, don't take me out so much. But they never complain about the mentors coming into the classroom and working with them there, so that seemed to be about. So the next stage when we try to spread this to more schools would be to use the mentor-teacher idea again, but have one mentor-teacher for, say, two or three schools instead of one. But we don't know if that's going to work or not.
And the paradigm that fits around that is the idea of having professional learning community, where it's seamless, basically. There's no drive-by professional development approach. There's not a standard delivered thing. It's not a come and get injected and we'll fix all of your problems in this half a day sort of situation. It's there continually. And it becomes a learning community because it's not exclusionary. That is, it includes everybody in the school, kids.
I should say we've also got team teaching going on in a class with 60 kids and two teachers. And while one of them is teaching, the other one's facilitating, and they talk with each other at the beginning and the end of each day. So there's a nice little learning community amongst the two of them that works quite well, too.
One of the things that you may not have picked up in one of those slides from this very elite school in Sydney was one of the images was a picture of the parents, community members, being involved in the school and being taught to use the same equipment that the kids were being used. And I have to tell you that I'm glad the conversation's moved away from what box we use, because I would have had it gotten up and moved away. collateral damage was getting a bit too thick in this direction. But the point is, it isn't actually the size of the box or what it looks like. The size actually doesn't matter. It is actually what you do with it. And I think that's the point that we need to get access to. We need to get access to space. We need to get access to the ability to communicate and collaborate. And everything else isn't related to the technology. And it's not just about the technology. And it becomes about the minds behind that access, that freeing up of the boundaries that we impose so well in institutional learning environments. And, you know, when you get a one-to-one situation, whether it's laptop or not, the fact is that we're empowering everybody. Compulsory reading is the book by Judy Breck, Connectivity, The Art of Ending Ignorance and Isolation. And it's that point of giving everybody a device that allows them to communicate.
I apologize that we've run out of time. I'll remind everybody that on the article in the proceedings are all of our email addresses, so you can continue these conversations with us. And I want to thank my panel very much for agreeing to participate tonight. And thanks all of you for coming and for sharing your stories also. Thank you.
Thank you.